Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
John DeNicola is an American singer, songwriter, and producer. During the 70s, John was part of a band which evolved into a seven-piece combo called Sweetback. The band ultimately split and John decided to backburner performing to focus on writing. Soon enough, he'd co-written both mega hits from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack, Hungry Eyes and I've Had the Time of My Life, which earned him an Academy Award and a Grammy nomination. John progressed to pen tunes for the likes of John Waite, discover up-and-comers such as Cara Flowers, who later changed their name to Maroon 5, and launched indie label OMAD, home to such diverse artists as Peter Lewis of Moby Grape fame and Robert LaRoche, former frontman of power pop progenitors The Size. It wasn't until 2019 that John came full circle with his debut solo album, The Why Because. 2 years later, he followed up with She Said, and he will release his next album shortly. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got John DeNicola. So tell us, where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I am in upstate New York in the U.S., kind of the Catskill Mountain, at the edge of it, the western edge of the Catskill Mountains, although we are also back and forth to New York City. But since COVID times, we've been here more than New York City.
Let's rewind. I know it's a multi-generational, multi-decade journey in the creative world, creating, producing, writing music. At what age, whether it was a child or a teenager, did you think, cool, I want to be in this space, this creative world? And how did that journey progress? So John's hybrid journey in the entertainment world.
Young, very young. I was very much drawn to music in like kindergarten or like first grade, or, you know, I just heard certain musics and just was drawn to it. There was something about, you know, it's hard to be specific about it, but it felt like a companion or something, you know. I don't know why I was thinking of that at that young age, but it felt like a companion, and it was, you know, I'm based in getting women's attention, I think. and not in a lewd way, just, you know, in a perfectly normal way. And so I started playing guitar at a young age, and I rapidly, in seventh grade, I'm trying to do the edited version, right? Yes. So in seventh grade, I met this other guy, these two brothers that played guitar, and we started a band. So I had a band started in seventh grade. And then by high school, out of high school, we had a full-fledged seven-piece horn band doing a lot of soul music and, R&B, which at that point in time morphed into disco. And then I went to Berklee College of Music after that, and was called back to do a jazz fusion album by a band called Flight, probably early 80s. Actually, it was on Motown, the record, and it was Erykah Badu sampled our song Face to Face for her hit song. Then so that was a jazz fusion thing. And I was very influenced by Jaco Pastorius as a bass player. And then that morphed into rediscovered pop music again, and started writing for an original band I was in. And then that brought me to meeting Frankie Previtt, who I wrote the Dirty Dancing songs with, The Time of My Life and Hungry Eyes. And that collaboration allowed me to continue in the music business. And now I am I'm doing my own records as an artist, playing multiple instruments and singing. And I also have a small record label, OMAD Records, and we have about 10 artists on the label that mostly I produce here in the studio. And I think that brings us up to date.
How come you only recently started releasing your own solo records? What was the thought process to say, okay, cool, I'm going to do it now? And why was it a longer period for you to get into that space?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I wish I had done it earlier, although maybe I wasn't ready for, I really don't know. 'Cause in that said band, I said in outside of high school into college, the college years, 20s, I did sing some lead vocal with this band, although we had like the greatest lead vocalist you could ever find in the band with us. So, but I did sing a song or two. I don't know. I just never saw myself out front. And when we kind of moved upstate here, we have this big barn and I put a studio. This studio is in a barn. I think the first thing I did was to, my son is a drummer. He's actually a filmmaker, but he's also a drummer. We set up the room to try out the sonics of the room to see if it would be good for drums. And I started recording a song that I had written, with also with Frankie Previte, that was in a movie with Sylvester Stallone, called Avenging Angelo. The song's name was You're the Only One, and a guy named Steve Holy sang it in the movie, but it never got released as a outside of the movie. So when I started here in the studio, I started re-recording that song to try and get it cut by another artist, and have it out on an album or something. And I built the tracks, and I just in the meantime threw my vocal down on it, and I played it for people, and they, didn't hate it. So that sort of kicked off my first record called The Why Because, and that was 2019. And doing my own music has been the most fun I've ever had, because many years I was trying to write for others and get in their heads as to what somebody might want to sing. And here I had no guardrails. I could do what I wanted to do. And I found that that was loads of fun, mostly because, I mean, I'm a bass player first and foremost, but I couldn't put down tracks for everything, and including drums, which I've done recently. So, I mean, if it's whether it's a Hammond organ or a Wurlitzer piano or a guitar or a marimba or drums or a sitar. And so that's just so much fun for me. And the first record I did, the Why Because, is songs. I looked around for songs that I had already written that might work with for me as an artist. I just compiling different songs, and I did end up putting Hungry Eyes in there. I discussed it with my son, and he I said, well, how do I do these songs? They're too big to mess with, And he said, well, he was saying a lot of indie rock bands are now kind of mining 80s synth pop. And so we went in that direction. For the time of my life, I put it at the very end of the record, because how do you do that song? So I ended up just an acoustic guitar, my voice, and a couple of French horns, and that. And so that was the genesis of that. And then my second record, She Said, was all songs I wrote for myself to do a record. So that was really the first pure John DeNicola as an artist record. So what took me so long? I don't know. I wish I would have done it sooner, to be honest with you. I love it. I'm working on a third record, actually.
And do you still write for others?
Yeah, here and there. Well, an artist, Peter Lewis, who I'm working with, which he is from the band Moby Grape, who maybe people know or don't know, but they were very influential on American musicians. They never had the fame, but they were very, very influential on, I just saw a footage of Robert Plant, accepting the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, mentioning we were influenced by Moby Grape. You know, little Stephen Beck,
yeah.
Chrissy Hunt, Cat Powers. I mean, a lot of reference to Moby Grape. So anyway, I started working with Peter. We've done two records together, and we started collaborating together. But I'm no longer, I guess maybe because I've aged out of you know, the pop. You know, I'm not going to write a song for you know, Lizzo anymore. But I'm having a lot of fun. I am working with some younger artists. We actually just put together a Christmas record from all the artists on the label. And that's really nice. Peter, by the way, going back to Peter Lewis, I don't know if you know who Loretta Young was.
Mm-hmm.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. That's his mom.
Okay.
And working with his daughter, Arwen, which of course would be her grandmother. We also, I did a couple of records with Arwen, one of them being 11 Moby Grape songs. She's singing. And of course, Peter is on it and also singing, but, you know, singing backup. So what was the question? Oh, am I writing for other people? You know, Peter, who else have I written for? That's about it lately. Okay. You know, myself mostly. That's mostly what I'm working on now, collaborating with other people.
So you reference that you produce... you're still producing artists, especially the ones that are on your indie label. So when you approach production for your own music compared to when you're producing other artists, what is the difference to those two different elements?
Yeah, well, is it kind of a big difference? I approach production with artists in a way that I'm just helping them get their vision out, what they hear. I am just a vessel to make that happen. But that said, though, for instance, I'm working with Robert LaRoche, who is actually on tour in Germany right now. With Robert, he writes his songs, and he'll come here and put an acoustic guitar down and a vocal track and maybe some electric guitar, and then I build around that. And he really enjoys my input on it, because I'm kind of coming from it completely different than he would, you know, with maybe a Mellotron or, you know, the way I play guitar, or I'll put a Hammond organ. He never had a Hammond organ on his records before. So in that regard, I guess I'm putting my stamp on it, but because it's here in my studio that we do it, a lot of it is done remotely, and I do put a lot of tracks down for these records, but you know, the person has to like what I've done. I'm married to anything. It's like I'm very easy that way. You know, well, you don't like that? Okay, fine. I'll try something else, or you know. So my ultimate goal is to have the artist have their vision rather than my vision. What if they need me to help pull that out of them, I'll do that. But, you know, if somebody is very adamant about what they want, absolutely. You, it's your record. I would never tell you how to do your record.
Why did you decide to launch your own independent label? What was the inclination behind that?
In the US, it's too big a machine to try and stay in that game. You know, I think even UK, it's a little, things are more open. It's here. It's very, you know, if it doesn't sell 50 million, we're not interested in it. You know, so with my own label, to be honest, I made enough money through the Dirty Dancing things and anything else that I've done that I was able to outfit a studio here and start a record label and do what I want. I don't have to try and get in. I'm not trying to please an A&R guy. We are able, and the artists that are on my label are able to put out the music that we aesthetically want to put out. There's nobody telling us how to do it. And it's really, it's art for art's sake. Because with streaming, there's not a lot of money coming back in. You know, some of my artists, thankfully, in a way, are artists that still sell CDs at their shows. You know, Robert in Germany, you know, Europe, and I don't know how South Africa is, but Europe still likes CDs and LPs. So I do the both. I do LPs and CDs, not always LPs, but most of the time LPs. And it's an untethered ability to do the music we want and like.
I love me a CD. I love the journey of the choice. For me, it's an energy exchange to the creator for all the hard work they've put in. I love the journey of the receiving, the unpacking, the booklet, listening from song one to whatever number. You've referenced it slightly. Maybe it's different in the States because overseas, especially Europe and the UK, vinyls are on uptick. Also in Australia, CDs are on uptick. In fact, in the UK, there's a basket of goods that they gauge for tax purposes, and vinyls have always been in that basket. But now because the upsurge of CDs again, CDs are back in that basket. And the stats are showing that it's actually the teenagers, the younger kids that are diving into that world, not to the older nostalgic people. You've also referenced that about the streaming and the platforms. What are your thoughts on the landscape at the moment?
I'm happy to hear that younger generation is, and it's just for the reason you mentioned. It's a, you know, it's something you can hold in your hands. It's a commitment to listen. You know, when you know, streaming is just like you put on Spotify and after the three or four songs that you wanted to hear, they start choosing stuff for you.
Yeah.
BS. I don't want to hear what you come up with. I want to, you know, I listen to the stuff I want. I mean, I guess once in a while it turns you on to something new, but I think you should be more deliberate when you know, when I was in ninth grade, I sat in my room. I came home from school, sat in my room, dropped the needle, which you feel the electric hit the vinyl and it comes out through your speakers. You can feel that in your hand.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I looked at the nice big album cover and just read every little last word while I was taken somewhere else. You know, it's kind of like, it's a different way of listening. It's not background music. And I'm happy to hear that. I don't see the model surviving. I don't see the model of streaming surviving. I don't see how it can, because who can afford to make music and get nothing back? Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm talking about my songs in a quarter, that's 3 months, right? I can get 10 million streams. That's freaking awesome, right?
Yeah.
I'm getting like $500 for that, you know? And a band, you know, if I'm a new band, a young 20-year-old kids, and I put a record out and I have 150,000 streams or 200,000 streams, that's pretty good. I got a lot of people listening to my music. I'm getting $10 for that.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
It's not, I don't know. Most of what is listened to, or a good chunk is the old music on streaming. And I don't know how they're going to keep making new music. I guess people start to accept that they're just not going to make money from it. And I understand, I guess it's a little bit of promotion so that when you play live somewhere, people might have listened to you, streamed you. But I mean, I and every one of these podcasts or anything I ever do, I always say, if you really want to support the artist you love, go download the album on iTunes or buy their CD or buy their LP. I still buy LPs all the time. I love LPs. I love that. That's the way you're going to keep music alive, by supporting the artist, by buying what they're putting out, not by streaming. That's not going to do it for them.
Yeah, so it's very interesting because a lot of people who are not specifically in the industry, they just enjoy music. They maybe stream it. They don't necessarily buy CDs or buy physicals. They go to concerts every now and then. There's a lot of lack of education in the sense that they don't realize this. In the region, so I teach spinning classes at the gym. And before my class earlier, I was speaking to about, About six, seven people. And I said to him, if an artist has had 100 million streams, and I said to him, how much do you think the artist makes? And they said, oh, $50 million.
Oh, my God.
I said, no, it's like $1,000 or $1,500. Wow. And they were so shocked to hear this information. So there's a lot of education that needs to be taught and listened and spoken to. So as part of my podcast, that's what I like giving education to the listeners.
We appreciate that. Us songwriters, you know, the artists get screwed enough. The songwriters, really, they're at the bottom of the payout from Spotify. They're like, they get like a tiniest percentage of what comes in. You know, do you know, I don't know, in the United States, you probably don't know this. In the United States, songwriters, since the 80s, whenever Ronald Reagan was president, cannot unionize. They're seen as individuals. They can't, you know, so we can't even unionize to like the screenwriters did here in the U.S.
Yeah.
They put their foot down. They said, this is what we're demanding. Songwriters can't do that because we're not allowed. Hopefully we can change that. That was, you know, from an era gone by, but so far it still holds up. That law holds up, but that's what we need to do. We need to, you know, you had some people make a little bit of a stand, Neil Young for a minute, Taylor Swift for a minute, but you know, everybody has to do it together and say, listen, you know, it's not like they're not making money. I mean, the streaming companies, the record labels, they're making money.
Loads. Yeah.
From streaming, it's the content. It's the people who make the content are the ones getting screwed, which is so counterintuitive. Should be the other way around.
Exactly. Because if it wasn't for you guys, there wouldn't be any content.
Right. I mean, you know, okay, so you're going to help us get it out to the public to hear. Okay. You should have maybe 10% for that or 20%.
Yes.
But not the lion's share.
It makes sense.
So I just don't see how it can, I don't see how it can last for too long. I don't know what will change, what will happen. But I don't see how this is a model that can last.
So you reference that you're busy working on your third album. What are the plans? What are the releases?
By the way, for all LPs that we do and CDs, I don't know if you know what the old style tip-on jacket means. It's a quality control, basically. It's a lot of records and particularly CDs end up in those little thin, you know, if it's not the jewel case, it's a little thin, papery.
Yes.
All your old records from the 70s and 80s and all that were tip-on jackets. It's instead of printing directly on a piece of thick paper, it's like a sticker that goes on cardboard.
Oh, okay.
And it's wrapped around the back. There's the first piece, the front piece is wrapped around, and then there's a big sticker on the back.
Yeah.
And that's how records were always made. You probably notice if you have an old record, maybe sometimes this starts to peel away, but it's so much more substantial and quality. So I do that with all LPs and CDs. Nope. I just had a company who manufactures for me. They had to cut, what do they call it? Die cut. Because they had never done CD tip-ons. So, but it, you know, a lot of times a CD in the middle gets really kind of weak. It's, you know, it's like, easy. Well, a tip-on CD has, it's just a quality control thing that OMAD does. But anyway, so I am working on Robert LaRoche's second record with OMAD Records. Robert was in a band called The Size. They had a couple of hits here in the U.S., a song called Think About Soul, back a ways, but now he's on his own. And as I said, he's touring in Europe. We're finishing that up. I'm about seven songs into my own record. I mentioned a band at a high school called Sweetback that my friend Tim was the lead singer. It was a seven-piece horn band. In fact, the our original sax player went on to Billy Joel's band. Rich Cannata was in Billy Joel's band for years. My friend Tim, who is this Irish-American fella that sounded like Ronnie Isley, he just passed. And so I wrote this song called King of His Own World. And I decided I'm going to get the old Sweetback guys together who I haven't played with for years. So I have the drummer from that band. My friend Ken was the guitarist, and I'm still very much in touch with him, but I had him play guitar on it, and the horn section, the original horn player, and the song King of His Own World about Tim. And there's three or four songs now on my new record where I'm using Sweetback. It's called with Sweetback. So it's a big horn, five piece horn section on like four of the songs. So I'm in the midst of that, but getting back to that, I'm working with Peter Lewis on some new songs through Peter and my love of Moby Grape. When I was 12 years old, I had their record, and it just influenced me so much as a bass player, their music. And Bob Mosley was their bass player, and he was one of the singers. They all sang in that band, but he had the voice that really spoke to me. So Bob has had a interesting life. He played with Neil Young. He was that record, The Ducks, not came out from the 70s recently. Bob had some hard times where he was living, you know, on the streets and under the freeway in San Diego. And he did this record in 1971. It came out, and you can find it streaming, but it had been out of print in both CDs and LPs for years. And it was a really good record, but somehow the mix, the drums were hardly audible and the bass was hardly audible. And this is a bass player's record. So I contacted Warner and to see if I could get the multi-track master. It was nowhere to be found, but I'm licensing it for Bob. I'm licensing that record. And through the AI that I probably Peter Jackson people kind of pioneered for the Get Back. I don't know if you saw the Get Back series. And they pioneered a way to, you know, if you're across the room and there's a bunch of room noise, we can separate your voice from all the other noise. Okay. So with AI, we took Bob's stuff and from this record and just separated the drums and the bass, because the middle stuff you can't really separate. The guitars and, say, Wurlitzer or horns, because they're in sort of the same frequencies, they don't separate out. But you can separate the drums out pretty good and the bass and the vocal. And that's what I did. And we're putting that out. So it's a reimagined Bob Mosley record, which I'm proud to have on the label, and actually all proceeds are going to Bob. I'm happy to do it. As I said, he probably one of the most influential influences on me as a bass player. And so that's going, what else? That's it. That, you know, Robert LaRoche record, we're only about halfway through. So that's so my record, Robert LaRoche record, some new Peter Lewis music, and getting that Bob Mosley record out. And
yeah, so a lot's happening in the pipeline. So I'm excited to hear all of these bits and bobs of music. So I'm looking forward, and I'll be on and the listeners will be on alert for that. So John, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
Oh gosh. I feel like, you know, music is a healing balm for all of us. And I hope we can all, you know, just tap into our inner humanity and be human to each other. And I hope that that kind of sentiment can infiltrate the whole world and move away from any sort of move towards autocrat-ish inklings and trust each other and trust in our ourselves to be better people.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.